UTC.
Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Wednesday, September 20, 2023. South Sudan's Minister of Foreign Affairs says President Salva Kiir is busy engaging his counterparts in New York to review punitive measures imposed on South Sudan.
So the president was able to engage with them, informing them about the suffering of the people of South Sudan under the unwarranted sanctions, individual targeted sanctions, as well as the arms embargo.
And a South Sudanese analyst says the U.S.-South Sudan relations is under siege.
The significance of this visit is hinged on that expectation that they would use this opportunity to discuss with the Americans the state of bilateral relations, which we all know have been in tatters for years now.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A first round of speeches was delivered by world leaders at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Many of them focused on their realities on the ground in their respective countries and the urgent need to improve the lives of millions of people. VOA's Veronica Balderas has details from New York.
On a rainy day in New York City, a somber reminder at the United Nations General Assembly of how world leaders are behind schedule in meeting the 17 Sustainable Development Goals they adopted in 2015 and hoped to achieve by 2030. Dennis Francis, President of the United Nations General Assembly.
Despite commitments to eradicate poverty and to reduce hunger being at the core of this agenda, alarmingly, 1.2 billion people were still living in multidimensional poverty as of 2022. It is estimated that approximately 8% of global population, or 680 million people, will still be facing hunger in 2030.
Young leaders also raised concerns about the lack of progress toward the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, demanding action to combat climate change and concrete solutions to empower their generation. This is how Mayeda Adel, a young leader for the SDGs, put it.
68 million young people are looking for jobs. All over the world, millions of young people are unable to access social protection coverage. Mental health problems like depression and anxiety are a serious concern for young people.
World leaders did manage to adopt on Monday a political declaration that brings a ray of hope to struggling economies, said United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
This includes clear support for an SDG stimulus of at least $500 billion a year, as well as an effective debt relief mechanism that supports payment suspensions, longer lending terms, and lower rates.
Guterres said countries can help get the SDGs back on track by paying attention to six targeted areas, including relieving hunger, ensuring gender equality, and improving education.
Our proposed Global Digital Compact will also help countries build safe digital systems that provide internet access for all, including students in hard-to-reach communities.
Guterres highlighted another initiative that aims to create 400 million new jobs, especially in the green, care, and digital sectors. He also emphasized that countries must act now to rescue the SDGs. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, the United Nations.
Still at the United Nations, South Sudan's Foreign Minister James Morgan Pitia says President Salva Kiir intends to plead with members of the Security Council to remove arms embargo slapped on South Sudan in 2018. PTSA's President Kiir, who is expected to address the Assembly Thursday, will also engage the Biden administration to review and lift individually targeted sanctions imposed on South Sudanese authorities by the U.S. and the United Nations.
Apart from attending the official opening, he also took some steps to engage with his colleagues, mainly the president of Gabon, the president of Mozambique, and the president of Ghana. You know very well that these three are what we call here as the A3s, A3 in the United Nations Peace and Security Council. They are members, rotational members for 2 years in this position. So the president was able to engage with them, informing them about the suffering of the people of South Sudan under the unwarranted sanctions, individual targeted sanctions, as well as the arms embargo, which are also imposed on the country.
The issues to do with the revitalized peace agreement, what other issues are very pressing for South Sudanese or for the South Sudan government that they would like to engage the United Nations on?
We are given the slot for the president to present his speech on September 21st. And that message is going to deliver. It's all about the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement and the roadmap. Yesterday, His Excellency met the Secretary General of the United Nations, His Excellency Antonio Guterres, and he was able to also convey that message of commitment to implement this revitalized peace agreement.
While you were away here in New York or in the United States, the parties to the revitalized peace agreement seem not to be agreeing on the way forward. I'll give you instances. On Friday, the Deputy Speaker of the National Assembly, Oyed Nathaniel, called for a press conference, and he said their party leader is literally held captive in Juba. He's not able to travel. He alleged that Dr. Riek Machar was invited to attend the General Assembly, but he was not allowed to leave the country. Could you tell us what is happening?
So you know very well that these bodies like the UN, like the African Union, like the regional body like IGAD, like any other international organization which has to do with the governments and the states, the invitation, if the United Nations has invited Riek Machar to attend the General Assembly or the United Nations General Assembly in New York, that by itself will be a breach to the constitution which is governing this body. Because you know very well that, John, I'm not talking with a layman here. I'm talking to somebody like you who is well-versed in the international affairs. You know it very well, that the UN General Assembly or the African Union or even IGAD cannot invite any other person apart from the head of state. That is it. If Nathaniel Oyet has the letter of that invitation, let him send it to you, and then you can be able to confirm that the invitation was really true.
Let's talk about the crisis that is engulfing the country because of the effect of the conflict in Sudan. I mean, how serious is this crisis affecting South Sudan?
In fact, the situation in Sudan is very unfortunate to all of us, the neighboring country. It is not only South Sudan. We have the situation in Chad. Similar situation with us in South Sudan, similar situation in all the neighboring countries. And that is always very unfortunate whenever anything happens in your neighborhood. Of course, it has got that kind of impact. So the situation is that whatever is going on also in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, we are not party to it, but we also feel that all the initiatives towards peace in Sudan should be harmonized and become a one initiative.
We're talking about conflict in Sudan. Just yesterday and today, Fashala is witnessing an ugly situation there where a former commander of the South Sudan People's Defense Force was killed And the local people took up arms. And today, the spokesperson for SSPDF made a statement that they are bombing the area to restore calm. I mean, why are we going back to this situation again?
Yeah, the situation in Fachala even happened when we are already here. So I think we may mainly leave that to what the spokesperson of the SSPDF has said, because we are very far, we are not home. And what he has said, I cannot add to what he has said, because he is the person on the ground and he might have gotten the right information. So I will not venture to say anything apart from what he has said.
That's James Morgan Petia, South Sudan's foreign minister, speaking with me from New York on Tuesday. In the second part of this interview, which airs Thursday, Petia talks about elections and census in South Sudan. A U.S.-based South Sudanese political analyst says President Kiir's presence at the ongoing 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly presents a valuable opportunity for him and his delegation to engage with the U.S. officials and attempt to mend the strained relationship between the two countries. Jokmadu Jok points out that despite the U.S. State Department decision to decline a request for President Kiir to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden, President Salva Kiir and his team should focus on maintaining diplomatic engagement with the Biden administration, implementing the 2018 peace agreement, and improving human rights records back home.
The significance of this visit is hinged on that expectation that they would use this opportunity to discuss with the Americans the state of bilateral relations, which we all know have been in tatters for years now, where the U.S. has been very critical, almost chiding the government of South Sudan on numerous issues, including human rights, corruption, and things like this. The U.S. has not hidden her disappointments or frustrations with Juba on the basis that the U.S. has always stood with the people of South Sudan for humanitarian issues, diplomatic support, even sometimes saying that they had been the ones who midwife the birth of South Sudan as a country. And so this disappointment has been expressed in so many ways, including the restriction to development aid and even reduction in the humanitarian funding. The U.S. has by far been the biggest donor to humanitarian operations. So I think President Kiir was hoping to revisit these relationships and discuss them with the highest authorities in this country. I think that is why he's here this time.
We have seen this letter addressed to South Sudan's current Foreign Affairs Minister, James Morgan, from the State Department, denying a request made by his predecessor, Deng Dao-Deng, for President Joe Biden to meet with President Salva Kiir while in town when he comes to Washington later. How do you see this move and the bilateral relations between South Sudan and the U.S. in general?
I think nothing is more expressive of that frustration that I was talking about than this letter. Basically snapping President Kiir, telling him the U.S. president is not available, has no time to meet. And yet we know that courtesies of this kind would have been very, very easy. It would have been easy for President Kiir to call on White House had the relationship been at the same level as they were at the time of independence. The letter that you referenced suggested that the president meets with the Undersecretary for African Affairs,
Molly Fee,
who was ambassador to South Sudan. The delegation should have taken that up and seek to meet Molly Fee, even despite the feeling that this was demeaning the status of the president to be asked to meet a junior staff when he had requested to meet the president.
This downgrading of the diplomatic engagement is reminiscent to me of what happened in December during the Africa Leaders Summit here in Washington, when President Joe Biden sent an invitation to President Kiir, but he decided to delegate his foreign affairs minister to come and meet Biden. My final question also is, what should President Kiir do to repair relations with the Biden administration and the U.S. in general? Sudan?
Well, maybe I should start with that last question there. I had a chance before to meet President Kiir, and one thing I said to him was that instead of people, you were people going to lobby in Washington to try to assuage the fears of the U.S. government and to try to convince them to restore relations, perhaps the best approach would be for the government to start doing small reforms within Juba, within the government. These reforms maybe fight corruption in earnest, try to put a lot of more effort into implementing the peace agreement, improving the human rights situation, freeing up the civic space, political and media and so forth. If you start these reforms, which are genuinely good for you, these reforms would be the basis for you now to tell the U.S. government that we are trying. We are faced with massive challenges, but we are doing our best. And we would rather be supported in what we have started rather than being snuffed out. On the U.S. invitation to the president of South Sudan to meet President Biden during the Africa Heads of State Summit, that was definitely a badly calculated response. Washington has read that as South Sudan always taking the U.S. for granted. U.S. support and U.S. moral and economic backing over the years that South Sudan government has taken this for granted. And I see this current declining of the requests by Juba for President Kiir to meet President Biden as being almost a tit for tat, which is what diplomacy is.
Reciprocity.
So if you decline an invitation to meet President Biden, why is it being seen so surprising that President Biden declines his invitation or his request? President Kiir now needs to make up his mind and allow his officials to meet at whatever level the U.S. government is offering, rather than feel offended and turn away from these meetings and just go back home without meeting anybody. I think that would not be useful for South Sudan.
That's Jock Madu Jock, South Sudanese political analyst and professor of anthropology at Syracuse University in New York. He spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio from New York earlier this morning. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a coalition of political parties reject a new bill giving President Kiir excessive powers. Find out why after the break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A coalition of political parties in South Sudan and some activists have rejected powers given to President Salva Kiir in the new national election bill to appoint some lawmakers in the National Assembly. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Some activists say that a part of the new bill is an attack on the country's democracy, adding that the passing of the elections bill infringes on the rights of the citizens. Lawmaker Majub Biel Turuk, chief whip of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, Oshawa, in the National Parliament, says his group rejected the allocation of excessive powers to the president.
We are thinking this is not a democratic way people should be appointed here and people are coming through elections. So why are you asking more people to be appointed if we are going to the democratic elections?
Paulino Lukudu, a senior member of other political parties, or OPP, says a national census should be carried out across the country before general elections are conducted in 2024.
In those days, in 2010, some administrative area was not in existence. But today they're in existence, and even some of these administrative areas has gone extra in creating more counties. We knew there were 79 counties, but in those administrative areas, there are more counties created without following the Local Government Act. It is not even passed by the Council of States.
Michael Makwe, South Sudan government spokesperson, who is a senior member of the SPLM loyal to President Kiir, says elections can be conducted without a national census.
There are people who say we will not go for elections unless the population census is conducted. For what? For you to conduct a population census, you need 2 years. We are not ready to go beyond.
Some activists have decried the passing of the bill and called for President Kiir to avoid signing it into a law. Deng Bol of Intrepid South Sudan describes the allocation of 5% powers to the president as an attack on democracy.
Such a number is ridiculous. And so my suggestion is 1%, only give 1% to the president. And that 1% should comprise of persons with disabilities and faith-based groups. Only 3 members of parliament to be appointed into the parliament by any president that comes thereafter.
SPLMI lawmakers on Monday walked out of the parliament during the voting process on the passing of the bill. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Bantu for some health issues. Health officials in Unity State say cases of measles have dropped in villages across the state following the recent outbreak attributed to the arrival of returnees and refugees fleeing the conflict in Sudan. The state health ministry says measles cases rose up to more than 1,000 in the whole state during May and June. For VOA News, Lith Nyak Jog reports from Bantu.
Dina Fly is the head of hospital run by the Praying Miracle charity Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, say though the outbreak was severe in the beginning, measles cases have dropped in the IDP camp in the first 1 week due to an ongoing mass vaccination campaign.
The last week we saw 82 cases, when previously we've been seeing about 120 cases. So it's still busy. Our wards are still full of cases, but not as overflowing as it was a few weeks ago.
Bly noted that several patients are still receiving treatment at MSF Run Hospital, but heard that the measles cases are less severe than in the first week.
The increase in measles cases is quite severe. Their condition when they came to the hospital was quite poor and it was quite severe. So it was definitely more severe than previous measles cases that we have seen in the hospital.
William Darwea, the acting director general in United States Health Ministry, his team is working with aid agency to vaccinate children aged between 6 and 15 against measles. They say out of targeted number of 223,000 children, health workers have so far vaccinated 58,000 children against measles and polio.
The returnees are put up in Rupkana Town, Bentiu Town, Ruria, and also in former FUC. All returnees, most population are found in those places. That's why we decided to vaccinate only on these areas, because of the lack of funds.
Aid agencies and health ministry began to vaccinate children against polio on September 4th, 2023, targeting 223,000 children. One of the returnees, Kuala, was 3 children dies of measles while fleeing the Sudan conflict, say he believed vaccination against the deadly disease will save many lives.
I have 3 children who have died on the way. One daughter died in Malakal and the others, 2 children, died in Nyarob. Because this disease is existing among the people, it is good that vaccination is done. Many children are finished on the way and a child who is not yet affected need to be vaccinated for prevention to make sure they are healthy.
State Health Ministry officials say they will vaccinate children in Rupkani County and in IDP camp. Children in the state 6 counties of Gwit, Mayom, Koch, Mayandi, Lare, and Payenjiar County will not receive vaccination due to financial constraint. For BOA News, I'm Lee Nyajwa in Bintu, United States.
A leading global risk consultancy says that despite the impacts of war in Ukraine, global inflation, climate and security challenges, Africa continues to find resilience. A new report by Control Risks and its economic consulting partner, Oxford Economics Africa, finds that as global tensions create disruptions, they are also providing many African governments significant political, economic, and security opportunities. For VOA News, Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The research released on Tuesday examines how African countries, governments and corporations navigate a world marked by global tension and competition for resources and alliances, particularly among China, Russia and the United States. The researchers focus on African states' efforts to retain neutrality while under pressure to join with global geopolitical corporations. Patricia Rodriguez, a senior analyst at Control Risks, a firm specializing in political, security and integrity risks, says Africa is attracting investment from various countries vying for support and access to the continent's economic opportunities.
What we've seen from major geopolitical actors, be that the US, China, Russia, or the EU as a bloc, everybody's increasingly viewing Africa as a place where they can entice to either align with them on key geopolitical or global affairs. And in doing so, there's a lot of at least pledged investment that is being directed towards the continent. In addition to this, African governments are attempting to, I guess, play all sides, so attempting to secure pledges of investment.
During the U.S.-Africa summit in December, Washington committed to allocate $55 billion to Africa over the next 3 years, focusing on healthcare, trade, climate change and women's issues. Recent reduced U.S. involvement in Africa has created opportunities for China, which has invested $10 billion in the continent from 2017 to 2022, and has also led to increased trade between Africa and Russia, growing from $9 billion in 2013 to $17.7 billion in 2021. These three major global powers compete to secure access to Africa's mineral resources, which are critical in advancing new technologies. Africa holds almost one-third of the world's mineral reserves, and 8% and 12% of global gas and oil reserves. Vincent Roche is the head of Control Risk. He says the demand for African mineral wealth has also created the urge to industrialize in the continent.
And so what we have seen in the last few months is more assertive moves by various countries to try to make sure that this surge in interest also benefits their economies. And we're seeing what you could call a critical resource nationalism coming back in some economies, where we see an insistence on local processing, more stringent local content requirements, and generally an attempt to integrate these critical mineral supply chain with a broader drive for industrialization.
In most African countries, natural capital accounts for between 30% to 50% of their overall wealth. The continent loses $195 billion yearly of its natural capital due to illicit financial flows, illegal mining, logging, the illegal trade in wildlife, unregulated fishing, and environmental damage. Researchers say North African countries are positioning themselves as manufacturing destinations as Western countries are looking to disengage from China. The head of Africa Macro at Oxford Economics Africa, Jacques Neal, says African countries will face challenges in an increasingly competitive global environment.
We continue to see progress. You know, it wasn't a short-term boost to access to financial services that we've seen. We continue to see the expansion and access to financial services improve across the continent, which is really important because, secondly, this is a catalyst for broader economic growth. You know, access to financial services is required and supports economic growth in most, if not all, other sectors of the economy.
According to researchers, wars on the continent are receiving little attention from the international community, although it is affecting the continent and attracting external actors such as Wagner and terror organizations. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday, September 20th, 2023. We now leave you with Freedom Boys and the song Mama Soura. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Carl Sterling, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
One more step, he gives a say. No kind of jive, be better.